Hello there everybody, my name is Sophie Aldred and I had the enormously great pleasure of playing the character of Ace in Doctor Who. And I would like to just remind you that you are listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. It's not private, it's public. And it means that you, the public, can listen to this Gallifrey Public Radio. And I'm very honoured to be on it and interviewed by it. So I hope you really enjoy the interview with me and all the other amazing stuff that they put out. And thank you, thank you, thank you for supporting Doctor Who all these years and for all this time. Because without you, Doctor Who wouldn't be the show it is today.
This is Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up.
Welcome to episode 446 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we have 10 characters, 3 major conflicts, and a half dozen locations across the universe to throw at you. And good night, everyone. Roll credits. I'm Jay.
I'm Julie.
I'm Kier.
And I'm Haley. And this week, the long-awaited 6-part Flux season begins with Chapter 1, The Halloween Apocalypse. Dogs and Dans and dangers everywhere you look. It's a lot. And we mean a lot to process.
So this wild story begins with the Doctor and Yaz escaping a near James Bond level of death traps set by Carvanista of the Lupari. And while they flee to Earth, so does the Dog Warrior, to abduct a Liverpudlian named Dan Lewis, who, by his own admission, is nobody special.
Before the TARDIS dematerializes, however, the Doctor is forcibly shown the prison break of a being known as the Swarm, who is apparently connected in some way to a massive orange cloud in space called the Flux, shown to be devouring entire planetary systems, as observed by...
an observation guard at a remote space outpost, Ender. But that is in no way clearly connected to a couple in the Arctic Circle who are ignoring a warning beacon, and they really should have, because Swarm shows up to claim his crystalline sister. Gasp!
Oh, and we have a weeping angel attacking a woman who claims to know the Doctor and Yaz from their future, an unexpected revelation about the 7 billion Lupari headed towards Earth, and a battalion of old-school Suntarans arriving in attack formation just to round things out. Keeping up, there's a quiz later.
Remembers what?
You and I. Dancing across space and time. Locked in combat. And now, after so long apart, we get to do it once more.
Yeah, so to say this was a bit of a busy first episode is a colossal understatement. So off the top, what are your impressions of how the frantic array of scenes and characters that we just witnessed how did it strike you?
Can you have two reactions at once? I guess you kind of.
Yeah,
I guess you can.
We are complex beings. I feel you can.
I'm capable
claim.
Of, yeah, of feeling two feels. Yeah. Well, half of me loves the fact that it's a hot mess, but it's a hot mess reminiscent of what we've been sort of cultivated to expect from classic Who setups, big finish first acts, things like that, where there is just this seemingly disparate, but nonetheless fraught with peril, all of these different aspects. And then you're just left at the first roll of the credits saying, how the hell does all this connect? And you want to know.
It kind of reminds me of like the first episode in Children of Earth in Torchwood and the first episode of Miracle Day in Torchwood, where it's like, we know we're telling one long story. And so the first episode isn't necessarily going to have like all our storytelling elements because it's not a whole story on its own. And it very much felt like that. Like, we're setting the stage today and getting all of our pieces in pace and ramping up some tension so we can ride this roller coaster for the next five episodes.
Mm.
Yeah, I 100% agree on that. I think that you get so much thrown at you that honestly, a day later, I couldn't remember a lot of it and had to watch it again just because there was so much that I don't think my brain could process all of the puzzle pieces, but I enjoyed the journey and I liked meeting the characters differently for each of them. And I think that the end scene kind of gives you that here's our jumping off point. Right. Let's keep going.
It does
now.
That quick cut through all of the players' faces.
Yeah.
But the only one that's in that I'm not really sure. Well, there's a few that I'm not really sure exactly how they all tie in, but the Vinder character is still really an outlier at the moment, other than just the fact that he observed it go by.
Well, we've been told, though, that he is somebody, right? Mm. Because of interviews and other things. But there were other characters who had about the same amount of screen time, and they were also included in that.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like, I mean, yeah, they're setting up a huge, big thing.
I'm excited about the big setup, because clearly this is leading to something much bigger. Because there are so many questions that you can't answer them all in just one more episode. You know, you can tell that this is a bigger thing. My problem is the fact that at the end of it, yes, you saw the flashes through all of the characters. And I'm like, aside from the Doctor and Yaz, I really don't have anything to care much about any of these. Like, they introduced so many characters that you never really got to appreciate any of them. With the exception possibly being the Kavanista. Who, you know, I like because he's a sassy bitch. It's just, he actually had a personality that came through where everybody else was just, they were either on screen for so little time or they just came across kind of milquetoast.
Well, I am intrigued by the Claire character, having the foreknowledge of the Doctor, right? Because that shows that, I like the fact that we right off the bat in episode one are given a reminder of, hey, timey-wiminess here. We're going to be seeing some characters asynchronously, and it's either a positive thing because, you know, she's going to be more important later, or it's a bad thing because she got time blooped by a weeping angel in her doorway because she couldn't find her keys fast enough. Which, incidentally, hot damn, the Weeping Angels are back.
Yeah, and so properly much back.
Better.
Yeah.
Yeah, so much better than Angels Take Manhattan.
Yeah. And it really reminded me of Blink a lot in the way that we got them this time. And it made me think that the way Claire meets the Doctor is kind of what would have happened in Blink if we had seen the story told from the Doctor and Martha's point of view.
Mm, true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The thing it reminded me of is, I don't know if any of you played the little mobile game, the one with Lonely Assassins. Osgood.
Yeah, I played a couple hours with it to sort of see where it went. Yeah.
It kind of reminded me of that kind of take on it. It was that same kind of it made the Weeping Angels scary again, where you were actually having to confront them instead of them being whatever they were previously outside of Blink.
Right. They were a formidable force, but they were never given the opportunity to be genuinely creepy. They were just there, constantly just attacking.
And letting other people be clever about how do we not let them actually move instead of letting them be the dangerous villain that they are.
Easy. Hit them with
an hammer. I like the fact that we actually saw them do what they're so very good at and like actually getting a hold of someone, because really the only other time we've seen that happen was with Amy. Because it usually always happens off screen, and this was kind of off screen, but it worked really well this way.
Yeah, that whole idea of you thought she made it.
Yeah.
And then that last little second of the door swinging back open again, saying, ah, you were so close, but you got time blooped.
And I think it's funny to see the different way that the angel interacts with what's going on, and then later on, some of the other villains.
Yeah.
Before I forget, though, the other character that I did like was seeing whoever this die person is to Dan, because we know that Dan is someone, and obviously he's in the TARDIS. Somehow he's connected to everything. Why was she singled out after? I mean, they could have just left her out of it after that.
Right.
But clearly there was something between she and Dan when they're standing on the steps, and they, like they were, it was like they were in high school and flirting. Yeah. And
it's not a date.
It was not a date, but it is kind of like,
yeah.
So I think that I'm hoping she's not a throwaway, and I'm hoping that we get to see a little bit more of her and figure out why she's been brought to wherever this damp house is.
Yeah, it's like the House of Black or something that she got sucked into. But it was but the last line given to her by what is the sister's name? Swarm's sister is like now named.
Did she have a name?
She does have a name. But he gave a name, and it was actually the funny thing was it was almost like the name of a rock. So I looked at it.
Geode.
Something, but it was like that, right? Yeah. But anyway, yeah, she throws a line. She says it through the doorway. She's like, "Oh, we're gonna have so much fun with you."
Yeah.
Before they pull her in. So she's gonna become a pawn in this thing too.
Yeah.
I don't know. With everything, I do love the fact that it was so frenetic, and I love the fact that there's just all of these things sort of dumped out on the board. Chatting briefly with Graham Burke from Reality Bomb, and he brought up an excellent point. And this is a particularly valid point with regards to Chris Chibnall. Say what you will about his writing. He has an adept hand at working within the milieu of Nordic crime dramas, like Broadchurch and Hinterland and Ichwil and things like that, where the pace is a little weird because it starts out insane, right from the opening credits. Everything's just nuts. People are dead. Everybody's got weird backstories. You don't trust anyone. The whole town's twisted. And then the pace slows down over the course of the middle three or whatever, so that you get a chance to dive in on your suspects, and it starts to knit together. And then you spend the third act of the series where you now see, this is what was really going on. And it's all about reveals that just rock you back on your heels.
And then you have to start over again.
Yeah, and then you go back to the beginning and say, how much of this crap did they give me at the beginning? Oh, I can't believe I missed that. So it's an interesting pace. But he's done it before with Broadchurch, and it looks like he's starting to kind of apply that a little bit to this.
Well, and I think he kind of, with this series in particular, was like, I'm going back into my element of telling a longer form story as opposed to the episodic stuff I've been doing up to this point. And I think that's going to be for the best. And I will also quickly mention that the sister's name is Azur, so you can quit yelling at your iPod.
Yes. Azur. Yeah.
Azure?
Yeah, Azure. Yeah, Azure Blue, which is why she had the blue crystals coming out of the split in her head there. Such good effect. Oh my God, their makeup looked amazing. The effects look really solid. Like
I can't wait to see these cosplayers at Galley.
That's tough. Yeah, if first person that can pull off either a Carbonista or Swarm or Azure, I will be much impressed.
I'm bringing my dog to be Carbonisa. That's it.
You're good.
It's basically a,
just give her a light up axe.
So of all of the many, 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 many questions that this episode brings up, what are the ones that you most want answered first?
Right off the bat, the top one that comes to mind is I cannot wait to see what the story is between the Doctor and the Swarm, because it's hinted at, like, this is something that happened before, like, you know, in her previous lives with the, you know, the Joe Grant or the Joe Martin Doctor and that kind of stuff, where I'm imagining like this epic battle where the Swarm gets dragged back to the start of the universe and locked away kind of thing. And it's, I want to see what comes of that. I want to see what the story was that led up to where we met him.
I want to know what iterations of the Doctor he's interacted with before, because is it going to be Doctors we've seen, Doctors before the Doctor had the name the Doctor, you know, because we know that there were iterations that we haven't seen. Is it going to be after the ones we've seen? Like, I'm just interested to see where in the Doctor's timeline this conflict takes place.
Yeah. Does Chibnall even, does he double down on the timeless child theory that's got everybody so wrangled?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I really think, I mean, that's, that kind of set the tone for that. Is like, I mean, we were kind of talking about how this, if, you know, if time is in flux and things like that, if time is unraveling or whatever the case was that we were speculating before, like, it would be the first perfect chance for him to like reset everything to status quo. And I'm like, right off the bat, the first time that he meets the Doctor, he's like, oh yeah, no, they completely erased everything before, but I remember everything that came. Like, yeah, there's something that's going to come out of this. He's not letting it go.
I kind of think all of this conflict takes place before William Hartnell's Doctor, because the flashes of memory we got in the Timeless Child story were about, you know, this police officer and his retirement and, you know, thank you for your service. This is the final thing. So what if that act of service for the Time Lords was whatever happened with Swarm? And that's what the memories, among other things, that got locked away.
Wow. That's a long game. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of my predominant questions right now, I mean, other than, you know, where does Vinder come into this when it starts stitching together, is why does Doctor have such a beef right now with Carvanista?
Something about the Dominion. That's my question.
Division.
Yeah, this is our Star Trek crossover.
Yeah. Right.
But this idea of the fact that the Doctor wants information on the Division, the Carvanista of the Lupari is one of the agents, apparently, of the Division. But she's pursuing him, and he's not only trying to keep her away, he's trying to kill her off because she won't leave him alone. It's like, what do I have to do to get rid of you, kind of a thing? It's not exactly how you handle somebody who just wants some answers to some questions. You could just say, you know what, I really have no knowledge of that. Move along.
Yeah.
Unless you've got things to hide.
Well,
but then that it's also tied into this bigger picture, everything else going on. That's where I want to know what that connector is. So how did we get from the very first scene to the rest of it, and how does that wrap?
The fact that we left off at the end of series 12 with the Timeless Children, the Doctor learning about previous lives and things like that, I wouldn't be surprised if the Division had something, had some kind of clue to that, or something like that would have been top of mind for her. And had she found some sort of clue or something, she probably would have gone after it like a rabid dog. No pun intended. But like, I'm suspecting that might be the tie-in. But it might also just be that this was this was one of those things where Chibnall was starting to outline it and said, okay, there's got to be something where he's going or she's going after the Carvanista. It's something to do with his organization or whatever. And it just kind of either gets dropped or cut or something. I can very easily see this becoming a plot thread that never gets resolved.
Oh, I think it absolutely gets resolved, especially since we weren't told what it was. Like, you almost get dropped in the middle of whatever that is. But also, so Carvanista is being chased because of his relationship to the Division, but is that completely separate from his duties with the Lupari, or are those things related? Or, like, That's something I'm not entirely clear on, and that could just be me not being clear on it.
It seemed like it was a separate thing, but this whole episode was so crazy that it very easily could have been just information that didn't make it.
I just need to watch it like 8 more times, and I'll be good.
No, it's gonna or that, or it's gonna unlock in like 3 or 4 episodes. It's like, oh god, that's the thing.
Yeah, I also want to know who the Ravengers are. We still haven't met them.
Ravengers, unless that's the name that refers to these two as a collective. We haven't been given that particular phrase yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, there may be something where if information is sought from other agents of the Division to find out about the Flux, do we know who the Ravengers actually turn out to the be?
Well, and wasn't he called the Swarm?
Swarm was his name.
Yeah.
So maybe they still are the Ravengers, but we just haven't confirmed that yet. We've just got their first names.
You mean
names.
There's more than one? Yes, because he had the sleeper agent and these poor folks that were just trying to live out there in the fjords.
Are there more than two, though? That's the question.
To be determined.
And how red is his face going to turn? Because he went from this sort of bluish shade to right at the end there, he was very purple.
And oh, yeah. So as he absorbs more people.
If he becomes Red Skull, I don't know how this is going to go.
The crystals grow and he becomes the TARDIS console.
That's another question, is what's going on with the TARDIS?
The TARDIS is sick and tired of being hit with goddamn mallets.
Right.
That's what the TARDIS
final is. Adjustment, final adjustment, quack.
Yeah.
I'd start barfing up black goo, too.
She only apologized once, and that's when she smashed a flipping hole in the time rotor.
Yeah.
What the flip?
The Doctor was very hostile in this episode.
Very. Well, here's the thing. I think the tension going on right now, or the tension that's very quickly coming to light between the Doctor and Yaz. We don't know exactly how long they've been traveling together, which incidentally should have been series 13, was just Doctor and Yaz traveling together. But that's another conversation.
Agreed.
But now that they've been having all these great things, they've been taking trapeze lessons, they've been doing all this great stuff, sleeping in one bed in the TARDIS.
I disagree. I think that was a catch.
Yeah, that was set up right.
There was a trampoline. Yeah.
I'm sorry, with blankets and pillows?
It was a quick, let's throw this here in case we come falling in from this plan that I made.
Yeah, so I at first was like, why do they have a big old bed in the middle of the TARDIS console room? Until I saw the trampoline next to it. And I was like, oh, maybe that was just there for that. But
I think the trampoline
insert
is
fan
just
fiction that, here.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. You fit what you want in your headcanon. I think that net thing that catches them is just there as a safety precaution anytime some projectile comes flinging in through the door.
I think it was legitimately a trampoline, and this was the plan.
Yeah, no, it was. There was a frame.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It had a circular frame. It was all stood up and... Mm-hmm. Anyways, yeah, insert your fanfic here. It's fine.
So, all told, though, with everything that has been thrown at the proverbial wall here, what are the highs and lows? What are the things that you were like most pleased, like fist pumping to see or hear or experience? And what are the things that you look back and say, you know, I'm not really sure if that ticked any boxes for me. What were your ups and downs?
I mean, the way the Doctor was treating Yaz, that did not tick boxes for me. It's like she's like been showing her like, oh, look at all this fun stuff we can do, but not being her friend the way she was in the first two series where, you know, it was my friends, my space fam. And now she's just like a passenger on the cruise ship.
Right. They become more workmates and less mates, maybe.
Yeah.
But then what was the standout? What was like a golden moment for you?
Oof. I mean, Yaz kind of just taking on a rescue mission on her own. You know, she's the senior companion on board, so she can handle that kind of responsibility.
Right. Yeah, being capable.
I forget who it was. One of our friends pointed out that Yaz probably had more lines in this episode than in the entirety of Series 11.
Very true. Yeah. But, I mean, I really like the rapport that she's got with Dan. I mean, they do some local digs, you know, Sheffield versus Leeds kind of thing. And
Liverpool.
Liverpool versus Leeds kind of thing. what is your problem with Sheffield? This is too close to Leeds.
I have to say that the standout for me was probably the Weeping Angel.
Yeah.
Like the way that was handled and the fact that it was left off in such a way that you know it's going to be a bigger thing later on. Like Claire knew what was coming. She knew that she was going to face it. So that means it's not over yet. This was not like a one-off like, oh, look, we're throwing all these villains in. I really like that. The fact that we're going to see it again and the fact that it was handled so well.
And we're also going to end up seeing Claire in at least two different spots in her timeline because we have to see her before the events that we saw in this episode because she knows the Doctor. And then after because of whatever happened with the Weeping Angel.
Yeah.
Unless that's just the last we see of her in that order. She could get blink back to something Jurassic and we don't know.
R.I.P. Claire.
Right.
Yeah. I got to say my absolute... It's not a small thing, but it's in the grand scheme. Seeing Dan Starkey as one of the classic Centaurans, was a woohoo kind of fist pumpy moment there, and getting to see the inside of a Centauran warship,
Yes.
So we've got a new ship interior to play with, and it, you know, it smacks a little bit of like their probe pods and things like that. It's got all the triangular repeating shapes and stuff, but it just looks so cool. And they're so disgusting again and awful again.
You look withered and old and decrepit.
Best not dwell on it.
But they're going to do it anyway.
And now we know what the old villain that Mendip Gill was referring to.
Yeah, right. That's very true, yeah.
One of the things that was my sort of thumbs down moment was how hard the Doctor was beating up the TARDIS. I just felt so bad for the TARDIS after the TARDIS was giving all of the signs of, hey, you need to pay attention. I'm bringing you here for a reason. And sometimes the Doctor takes that positively and says, like, yeah, we're here. And sometimes the Doctor is like, why would you bring me here? Mm-hmm. And then the cloister bells being one of those iconic things that we see. Oh,
I get goosebumps every time the cloister bells start ringing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know bad stuff's going to happen, but you're like, ooh, do it again.
Yeah. So I think, like, the Doctor trusts the TARDIS so much, but then in those key moments just is flippant and doesn't.
That's
so
true.
So I understand why, but I didn't like it.
Yeah.
And then I think there were some really great moments where the humor coming from the Doctor just being the Doctor, I laughed out loud every time I watched it.
There were a lot of lists. One of the things that Jodie does so well is, and they and Chibnall writes it in for her all the time, is, all right, one, I've got three things to ask. One, this. Two, this. Three, what is that signal behind you? Like, what is that call sign behind you?
But that was more of a distraction. Like, there was one, which she got through, and then two, but then halfway through two, I retract. And then the way, this was one of my favorite moments, the way her hands go up, like, hee-hee, what is that over there? I can't stop with that thing over there. And so my hands are doing this thing down here.
She did the same thing when she noticed the swanky laptop in Dan's flat. Like, you know? She's like, hey, there's this thing. But moreover, boop, and pointing over that thing. So,
those are some of my favorite, how Jodie handles the Doctor.
Yeah.
Love it.
There is one, I didn't mention what I thought was kind of a low point, but it's because I didn't really want to bring everything down, but I didn't like the fact that they decided to kill off another black woman in this episode. Just boop, just say, all right, well, you know, we did it in series 11. Oh, we did it again in series 12. Oh, let's do it again in series 13. Little too easy to go about that, because I think there was that idea of there's a number of different ways that could have been handled. The maybe the assimilation was something where it was like a bodily takeover or something like that, but I don't know. That still kind of rankles me a little bit. I did notice that with this, there's a color pattern to this. I noticed tonality and stuff, and I know the score was definitely ramped up. This is some of the most dramatic kind of driving, you know, thumping percussion and stuff that Akinola has put into the scores. I think specifically because we're trying to drive this thing that it's everything's nuts and it's crazy and we're all going to die and that thing up there and what the hell is that? But from this play with blue and orange that started with the TARDIS interior redesign when that came out, and everyone says, I don't like it. You changed the interior kind of thing. But now that becomes the predominant tone for the balances in a lot of these sequences. We've got this orange cloud that's taking everything over, and all of the Doctor's sequences are generally cast in blue tones. Mm-hmm. It's subtle, but it's definitely there.
Ooh, are we going to get an out of gas kind of thing where sometimes are one color, other times are this, like where it's breaking apart could be shaded differently? Like out of gas from Firefly, where everything in the past was orange, present was blue, and then future is like normal colored or something like that.
Yeah, they did a wash over it. Not that wash, different wash from Firefly. Sorry, I can't use that term. But yeah, they did it sort of sepia for flashbacks.
Warmer tones for the recent flashback.
But this this was even more subtle in that regard, because it didn't really necessarily have to do with where you were chronologically. It had to do with who had the upper hand.
Ah.
So when Vinder's recording his situation reports, you know, number 700 or however, so tens of thousands of these things.
70,000 something.
Right. Everything is just done in cooler tones, but when everything goes haywire, everything is now cast over in hotter colors.
Yeah.
And granted, some of that is just basic cinematography, you know, put panic colors up there to get people interested and that sort of thing. But we even had moments specifically with the Doctor and Yaz where it's done in blues and purples and whatnot, and yet things are still bonkers pants. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. How about his moment where he's kind of very nicely giving his report, and then he goes, "So thank you for sending me out here, you bastards."
Yeah, I am interested to see more of his character, because it does seem like he's got that kind of attitude that could be a lot of fun. But
From what little we've gotten of him, mm-hmm. I mean, anyone who can be out there for who knows how long he's been stationed, and he's a commander, you know, he's been given this responsibility. He's gone through the ranks only to be stuck out here on Outpost Rose. Maybe it doesn't mean anything. Maybe it's because the ship was sort of
shaped like a
rose blossom. But he's still, as much as he hates the job, it hasn't broken him.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something to his resolve that just says, yeah, I get to, you know, this is my view every single day. And that's pretty sweet. You know, that's all right. Good on you, mate, for staying positive. I dig that vibe. I like your style.
Yeah. But don't leave out an opportunity to get in that dig. Yeah.
Signing off. Hope you die. Good night, Wesley.
So we said last time that the way Chibnall could best redeem himself in the eyes of those unhappy with his writing would be to establish an intense, riveting story from the start that compels fans, naysayers, everyone to watch and see what's going to happen. Does this do that?
Ugh.
It's certainly got the what the hell factor to it, mm-hmm. that might make people want to come back just to see what, because there's a lot of questions. And honestly, the most of the feedback I've gotten from people, like coworkers and things like that, has been pretty positive. You know, it's an exciting episode. There's lots of things coming. You know that it's going to be a big story, but there are those people who really do like to focus on characters, and those people really didn't get a whole lot here.
Right.
But I think they're going to get a lot more of that throughout the series than you normally would, because instead of having, you know, two new characters every single episode that you're only going to have for that episode, you're getting, well, it seems like about four new characters that we're going to have for the entire run.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they die before then.
That we hope we're going to learn more. In addition to folks that are going to come stumbling through the door over the course of the next couple of weeks.
Those people are going to be lost.
Oh, no, I meant characters.
Oh, I thought you meant people that were like, I didn't watch the first episode, but I'm going to watch two.
That's the other thing, is that if we're talking about people that are trying to say, hey, come back to give him one more shot because he's doing this great thematic thing and this is going to be really intense, and then they see this, and it goes back to what Jay was saying at the beginning about the idea of, you know, this barrage of stuff that's getting thrown at you. Some people really respond to that. Other people who expect to see at least some closure at the end of each segment, yes, the overall arc continues, but the little piece of the story that we've been working on has its closure before we move on to the next. If they're not prepared for that or are really cognizant of that, this is really going to throw them. And I don't think they're going to tune back in the next week.
They may be the people who wait until the end and then just binge it all together.
Yeah, true.
Because and they honestly, want the whole story.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And honestly, if I had a choice, I like to watch TV that way because I want to get sucked in and I want to just live in it.
Mm.
But I also love the idea of, especially for something like this, where there are going to be a lot of pieces and you can guess at the story and you think about it 2 days later and you go, ooh, but what about this? And you get those moments of, this was so interesting, but we do this and we like to talk about it and we like to watch it a couple of times. But again, as I said sort of at the beginning, there was a lot in those last 5 minutes that I didn't even remember for to the next day. So how am I supposed to be reminded of that as a casual viewer a week later, or maybe like a week and a few days when I finally get my chance to watch episode number two?
Previously on.
Yeah, but how do you capture every single one of those moments again?
Well, and
so much going on.
I think for that,
they'll leave people behind. Like, if you can't keep up, I think you're going to get left behind.
For that reason, though, that's why I don't think that we're going to have a solid answer to this question until much later than the final episode airs. Because you're going to have people that come to it late. Because honestly, like, I went onto my work, onto Slack yesterday at work, and was like, okay, who watched the episode? What did you think? And the only responses I got was, there's a new episode? So I had to wait until today to actually talk to people because nobody knew. So you've got people
that's very true.
Yeah, they aren't coming back to it on time. You've got the people who are going to wait until it's all wrapped up to watch it all. And then you've got people like us, like most Whovians, I think, who are going to want to watch it multiple times to get all of the little tidbits out of it.
Right.
So that I'm not going to know what my feeling is on this entire story the day after the last episode airs. It's sure. going to be weeks after that when I've gone back and watched it three or four times, and I can pick apart the little things that I like to pay attention to.
But that places a huge burden. Well, it places a large target on the series being one that in order to get full enjoyment out of, you're being expected to watch it more than one time per episode. Mm-hmm. Grant, I understand. I'll be the first one to say that viewing tendencies and viewing behavior has dramatically changed mm-hmm. in the course of the past 5 years alone. But very few times does that actually require multiple viewings. There may be something that was so well done that you're like, you know what? I can't wait to go back and watch that again just to see what I missed or see what all the little fun breadcrumbs they were throwing along. But if you need a viewing and a half to 2.5 viewings just to understand the scope of what you're seeing, you're putting a huge burden on a casual viewer, and that casual viewer will tap out.
Yeah.
True.
Right. When you feel like you have to watch episode one before you watch two, and then you watch one, two to watch three, and then you watch one, two, three to watch four, that's a bit much.
I hope
they start to stitch together a little bit more cleanly.
I think if episode two has kind of a same feel and flow to it as episode one, we might start seeing a lot of the audience be like, you know what, I'm going to wait for it to all be done so I can watch it all at once, because episode to episode isn't working for me with this story.
I also don't think that it's going to be a thing where everybody goes back and wants to rewatch it multiple times or has to. I think that more than likely what's going to happen is for people that really enjoy it, they're going to get through six and they're going to be like, I want to go back and, you know, watch a little and try and catch the things from the early episodes that had no frame of reference. And then if they, you know, if it's really good, then yeah, they'll get sucked back in and watch it all the way through. But I only think the first couple episodes are going to be the ones that people really revisit shortly after. Unless you're insane like me.
Fair point.
You know, losers. I don't know. It's
dedicated fans.
Dedicated fans, sure. Yeah.
I don't think that viewership numbers are going to mean anything for this story. It's all going to come out in the wash afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, especially in light of everything right now. Like, I'm hearing all the kerfuffle going on right now with AMC Plus. And again, we've got another shuffle of rights and broadcasting.
I was going to save this rant for after we finished recording, but...
No, rant on.
We pay for a lot of streaming subscriptions in this household. Among those are HBO Max and Hulu Plus Live TV. And HBO Max does not have the new episodes, and Hulu Plus Live TV has BBC America, but apparently doesn't include Doctor Who episodes on demand. So I could have watched it live as it aired, but after the fact, did not have access to the episode anymore. So I can add AMC Plus to my, I don't know, I think we have a dozen streaming services that we are paying money for to watch Doctor Who.
Right. There's the determining factor of who actually is holding the puppet strings right now is a hot goddamn mess. And I'm really sorry to the – we've had a number of folks who have reached out to us through direct messages and feedback emails and whatnot saying, yeah, is there going to be any sort of a standard of practice as to how these things are going to be doled out? But no, absolutely not. And it's going to differ. Sorry, Canada. Things are all screwy up there with space. I mean CTV sci-fi or whatever they're calling it now. And they're
yeah.
The days of just saying this one is owned by Netflix or this one is owned by Amazon or this one just broadcasts direct and you've got to go to their site to get it. Or even just simplifying and saying, oh, it's done by a season pass purchase and you just go to Google or you go to iTunes and you just buy in advance. It's not even that simple anymore. So yeah. I'm
and by next season, it could be entirely different again.
Absolutely will be, because at that point, knowing that you've got Bad Wolf Productions in there with some of their network and distribution contracts and RTD at the helm, who's got very, very specific plans about how he wants the masses to be able to access his content. And he's got a little bit more executive lean on being able to go back to the powers that be. And if BBC is just washing their hands of this and saying, you know what, do what you want, call it a British product so that we can ride the coattails of this thing. But we're done trying to market this or trying to put it into people's hands. You handle it. We're just going to put it on BBC One and then walk away.
The fact that most people didn't know that it was coming. Like, and even after the fact that it had aired, they were unaware that it happened.
Yep.
And then those of us who wanted to watch it but do not have cable were, you know, out of luck entirely, because I'm sitting there at like 5 o'clock on Sunday, and, you know, it's been out for 5-6 hours at that point, just like going through like, okay, where can I watch this?
Mm-hmm. It's on top of that frustration, like, I did the same search, and the very first thing that popped up was like, start your free trial of HBO Max today.
Yeah.
And then
yeah,
the next one.
So you can
one,
watch last season.
Yeah. And then the next one was an article about like, oh, you can watch it on all these things. And it said, oh, and if you've got any of the like live TV included in your package streaming services, you should be able to watch it there. And that was also not accurate.
Part of the thing that helped Doctor Who reach the level that it did was the fact that it was on Netflix. Now the barrier to entry has become so massive, it's nigh impossible to bring new people into the show.
I will go out on a limb and say that regardless of what the general conventional wisdom is about Chris Chibnall's writing and show running, if the show were being provided next day on Netflix throughout the last two seasons into this season, the show would be in very much different shape right now.
Or even next day on HBO Max, if that's who they're going to have their agreement with. Like, I think HBO Max has become a big enough streaming platform that you could make that sell to people as well.
Yeah. If it were available to people to watch, then yeah, it would be a different thing.
Mm-hmm. Might be something we're going to have after the next 6 insane weeks go by. And
right.
when we
have like 2 years before the next series.
Yeah. When we have some rearview mirror conversations, there are a couple folks that I'd like to be able to talk to about distribution formats and sort of talk to the source about why this is as complicated, or is it as complicated as it needs to be? Has this just been the product of a lot of really clunky decisions, or is there something else going on under the hood that we're not aware of? Because I'm so frustrated by it, but that doesn't have any bearing on the show right now. Right now, we've got orange clouds of Tang ripping the universe apart.
Eating vortex energy, and we don't know what happens after it does.
Well, everybody gets cool crystal haircuts.
Right? Yeah, I there are so many questions. I can't wait to see what comes in the next episode, because it's just, it's exciting.
Also, and a moment just to say, we finally have some new Who to watch. Yay.
Don't get used to it.
New stories we're talking about here.
Yeah.
I'm talking over here.
Well, so next week, obviously, we will be coming back with Chapter 2, The War of the Santarans.
Attack! What a great line to end on. Attack.
I think this one's going to have a bit more structure. So anyone that kind of like didn't care for this one because it was so crazy, I understand that it was probably just because it was set up. This one is going to have more structure to it.
I have a funny feeling that this is going to be one where we get the current, we get glimpses of the current skirmish, the Centaurans invading, and then it's going to keep flashing back to the Crimean War and Centaurans killing British soldiers, and then back and forth, and some sort of a clever parallel.
I can't wait to see redcoats and Centaurans on the battlefield. It's going to be great.
Yep. It's like potatoes with ketchup.
Oh. Yeah, we're going to have to cut that out. This has been episode 446 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, what's the flux? It's a hurricane ripping through the structure of this universe, disrupting every particle, the failing of structure of the universe, a cataclysm of unknown... We're not sure.
This is Kira saying, I've got a bone to pick with you. Ah!
This is Julie saying, all right, on three, we sync our watches. Not wearing a watch, just... Let's go.
And this is Haley saying, I can't wait to see the puppies versus the potatoes.
We'll see you next week.
And we'll see.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Want to keep the conversation going? You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Or just send us a good old-fashioned email to feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also give us a phone call at 754-225-5477. That's 754-CALL-GPR, and you may hear your voice on a future episode of the show. Everything's got to end sometime, otherwise nothing would ever get started. Join us next week for a brand new episode.
Jacob Hansen. Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2021. We'll see you next week.